From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's America's pastime. The fresh-cut field, fastballs, the grand slams. Baseball is as American as, well, you know. Today, think baseball, and you may think Josh Hamilton, Big Pappy, Big Money, even Big Scandal, A-Rod. But before the money, there was the romance of the minor leagues. Or was it just a grind? The minor league pay stubs, lots of young talent vying for a small number of openings in the show. Diehard fans, who knew you when? This hour, On Point. Minor leagues, major dreams. You can join us on air or online. Do you love baseball in the minor key? Is it more real and raw and accessible than the pricey major league version? A place where the players might know your name. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, last night, the reigning Major League champions took the field. You may have been watching. I was at Fenway Park in Boston, where the Red Sox beat the Texas Rangers. Here's Red Sox outfielder Jackie Bradley Jr. driving in two runs.
There he goes at first base, and it's lined into left field, a base hit for Bradley. From third comes Pierzynski. And they will stop at third base. Herrera, the second RBI single of the night for Bradley. He's driven in both runs, and the Red Sox take a 2-1 lead.
But there's thunder down the highway in New Jersey, too. The Trenton Thunder in a double-A matchup with the New Hampshire Fisher Cats. In the fourth inning on Sunday, 14 batters brought in 11 runs, topped off by center fielder Gary Sanchez, a top Yankees prospect, with a grand slam.
Here's the 2-0 to Sanchez. He swings and crushes it deep to center field. Headed back is Jones. It's gone. A grand slam for Gary Sanchez. It's an 11-run frame for the Thunder, and they lead 11-3 here in the bottom of the fourth.
Now, later this hour, we'll hear from one minor league radio announcer who calls the hits, runs, and errors, and a young double-A pitcher taking his shot at the big leagues. But first, joining me now in the studio is Lucas Mann, writer, journalist, a high school and college ball player himself, and a super fan in his own right. When he was 24, he spent a year following the people and players of Clinton, Iowa, home of the Class A minor league team, the Lumber Kings. His book, Class A, Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere, is just out in paperback. We've got an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. He also recently wrote a piece for Slate headlined Minor Leagues, Microscopic Paychecks. Lucas Mann, thanks for joining me. Great to have you in the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lucas, let me just start. Before I get to the microscopic paycheck issue, what do you love about baseball? And did you find it, see it, feel it when you went to Clinton, Iowa?
I think the short answer is yes. I think the motivations that brought me to watching baseball there, other than the sort of crass I wanted to write motivations, were I think what a lot of people have in their relationship with baseball. A lot of my relationship with my father growing up was based around playing baseball and trying to be better at baseball and trying to feel some satisfaction from that.
What was your position?
I was a very bad pitcher, ultimately. But at the time, it didn't feel that way. So I was sort of drawing from that. You know, that kind of
lineage. I peaked in the sixth grade myself. I was a pitcher also.
I think I made it to seventh or eighth, and then it was a slow, painful decline. But I think one of the funny things about something like baseball is that for me and a lot of the people that I met at the games and people that I know, that still felt really, really vivid. I still sort of felt like a baseball person and like baseball was an important part of my life, despite how all of the actual signs pointed it to that not really being the case.
One of the things that occurred to me as I went through your book is at different points, sometimes it's about birth, the beginning of a season, the birth of dreams. Sometimes it's about death. That is, the dreams dying, the season ending. Even you had some of the members of the extended family of the Clinton Lumber Kings. A fan would die and his friend would come out and throw out the first pitch. How did you think of the arc of your book and you know, people use baseball for metaphors of all sorts of things. What's the one that sticks in your head?
I think I was trying to, I imagine that there were about a million metaphors ringing out through it. I tried to avoid a central metaphor. I tried to avoid making it that overt. One of the things that's really appealing to me about writing about a season, writing about baseball, is that story, that sort of ebb and flow, the birth and death is there, right? The season starts and the season ends. The season starts in spring and in Iowa, you see the corn coming up. And then the season ends and you see the corn sort of yellowed and drying. And so all of that's already there.
You also talked about this town, Clinton, Iowa, that told the story of a lot of small towns of economic out-migration and factories closing mm-hmm. and people adjusting to lower paychecks.
Yeah, it's sort of that ebb and flow that's in the baseball season. I think one of the things that is really appealing to baseball is that it's sort of a microcosm of the way that happens in our lives. And particularly, there's so much mythology about baseball. You watch baseball and it never feels like you're just watching that moment. You're watching with sort of a whole litany of personal and cultural memories attached to it. And in a place like Clinton, even the name of the team, the Lumber Kings, goes back to a time a little over a century ago when Clinton was a lumber processing capital of the world and there were more millionaires per capita in Clinton than anywhere in America. So even that sort of harkens back to this economic prosperity and people had seen those ebbs and flows in their lives and it definitely felt deeply connected to what was happening on the field.
Let me ask you about the issue of the paychecks that you mentioned, because on the one hand, you could see going to baseball games in this intimate little stadium, seeing kids who are not that far out of high school playing, and you could imagine the joy of the game. On the other hand, you look at these players, most of whom won't make it to the major leagues, who are making a very small amount of money. And I wonder how you see that system. You know, we've recently had a case where college athletes at Northwestern, at least preliminarily, have won the right to unionize. How do you see the plight or the good fortune of those minor league baseball players?
So, right, what I mentioned in Slate was right alongside essentially the same timeline as that college attempt to unionize and now getting the right to. There's a lawsuit being filed by former minor league players essentially saying we don't have union representation and we're suing for sub minimum wage back pay and also overtime. And it's a plight that I think feels very connected. And I think the same arguments are made against it. This is a privilege. You're playing a game. You are getting the chance to better yourself towards ultimately huge fame and a huge payday.
Do most of the young men who you spent a year with, did they seem to love what they were doing? Or was it a struggle for them?
I think it was both. And I think that it's really hard from the outside when fans are looking at it. You know, you hear an athlete complain, there's almost nothing that gets people riled up more because, I mean, I say in the book, I was registering all of the difficult realities that they were going through. But if somebody was like, hey, pick up a glove, join the team, I would have dropped my whole life and done it. And so I think it's really hard for people to empathize with them. And I think they do love the
game. But it is easier to empathize with some of those players if the person with a job at a retail store realizes that the player makes less money than they do.
Absolutely. And that was the reality. I mean, these guys were making very, very little money.
What do they make, $200 a week, something like that?
It works out to for a first-year low-level minor leaguer, the base pay is always $1,100 a month.
$1,100 a month.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then it goes up. It goes up from there and it's open to negotiation. But if you're a guy who's hanging around in single A for more than a year, you don't exactly have a huge bargaining advantage. So it can stay pretty low around that. And I mean, those are incredibly difficult wages for anybody. So it presents this weird thing of, yeah, I think the players love playing baseball and it's what they do and have done. But they're also playing that game that they love with an enormous amount of A, financial duress in some cases, and B, pressure. I mean, it's not just, boy, it felt good to hit a home run. It's, I hit a home run. I hope that the right person was watching. What happens if I have more home runs than this guy and I get sent up? Who's in my way? Right? I mean, they're not playing for glory in single A.
You had a couple of stars on the team, Nick Hamilton.
Nick Franklin.
Nick Franklin, Erasmo Ramirez, mm-hmm. Both of whom are in the major leagues. Did most of the players on that team, you think, nurture a realistic dream that they were going to be in the major leagues? Or were they just playing out the string of something they'd done all their lives?
That was sort of a fascinating tension that kind of brought me through the whole book. And I had a great conversation with the manager at the time of the Lumber Kings, guy John Tamargo, sort of this great baseball lifer. And I was talking to him about sort of his playing days when he kind of got to the majors and then it didn't happen. He was a backup for a little while and talking about his players.
I think he had four home runs in the majors.
Yeah. And you know, that's amazing, but it felt like not enough. And he was saying, the thing is, probably somewhere a lot of these guys know, right, if you're a backup catcher on a single A team and you're not getting many at bats, there has to be a logical part that knows that this is a long shot. But what Tamargo told me was that the moment a guy starts saying out loud and admitting to himself and others that this isn't going to happen, that's when he should quit. That's when it's just, you've acknowledged something that's too big to overcome.
Although it sounds from your description in the book that some of the up or out mentality has drained away from it. It's not as quickly out as it used to be in the past. But stay right there, Lucas, man. We're talking about baseball's minor leagues. Here's country band Alabama with The Cheap Seats, all about the love of the minor leagues. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about baseball, with the season just underway. Minor league baseball. Now in August, facing off against the Arkansas Travelers in Springdale, Arkansas, Jorge Bonifacio of the Northwest Arkansas Naturals, stepped to the plate in the seventh, and here's what happened.
Swings here, and it's a high, majestic drive, way back to left. Get out of here, ball! Jorge Bonifacio with a three-run blast to left, and it's 9-5 as the Naturals cut into the lead.
Now, I'm talking today with Lucas Mann. He's the author of Class A, Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere. He spent a year with the minor league team, the Clinton, Iowa Lumber Kings, a Class A affiliate of the Seattle Mariners. Also joining me now is a young player in double-A ball who's fighting to move up, Andrew Triggs. A college star at the University of Southern California, as much a baseball power as Alabama in college football or Duke in basketball, Andrew now pitches for the Northwest Arkansas Naturals, the team that you just heard from, a farm team for the Kansas City Royals. Previously, he was with the Kane County Cougars, a Chicago club's Class A team. He's also, I should say, a member of my own family, the son of my first cousin. Andrew Triggs, on the road from Midland, Texas, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Andrew, first of all, did you ever play the Clinton, Iowa Lumber Kings?
I did, actually, a few times, and also with Jorge Bonifacio from that previous segment. So we, at the time, minor league teams change affiliations every 2 years or so, and sometimes they sign multi-year agreements, but we were actually the Kane County Cougars were a Royals affiliate at the time. It's now a Cubs affiliate, but yeah, we did play in Clinton, Iowa, and I will say, and I'm sure Lucas would verify this, that is about as authentic as it gets.
Yeah, I think that's well put.
Well, I was struck by Lucas's description of the stadiums where the crowds were sparse. It was a very small number of people there, and the players would recognize the fans, know their names, and really, you know, become part of each other's lives, at least for a brief period of time. Is that the experience that you had in that league?
Yeah, it's exceptionally unique. You get a lot of local people who have been affiliated with the club, whether they be host families or just boosters who bring food after the games, and they've really been there since the beginning. And a lot of times, you know, their favorite players aren't the ones that have gone on to major league stardom. They're the ones that, you know, they had 10 years ago who lived in the apartment above their garage, and now they come back every year at Easter or something like that. So it really is a part of the blood of these towns or these minor league teams, and you really see that, and it really connects with some of the locals. So it's neat to be a part of it.
Andrew, a lot of people learned about minor league baseball from the movie Bull Durham, which was before your time. I'm imagining you may have seen it, but a lot of our listeners certainly have. And I want to play a little clip. This is from the film in 1988. Bull Durham was a minor league catcher, or that was the team that minor league catcher Crash Davis, played by Kevin Costner, played for. He tells his team about his coveted 21 days in the big leagues.
You know, you never handle your luggage in a show. Somebody else carries your bags. It's great. You hit white balls for batting practice.
White balls.
Ballparks are like cathedrals. Women all have long legs and brains.
Ooh, they're really hot, huh?
Yeah, and so are the pitchers. They throw ungodly breaking stuff in the show. Exploding sliders. Could be one of those guys.
Now, Andrew, do you spend a good chunk of your minor league career thinking thoughts like that? That you're just imagining yourself taking that next step, and how close do you think you are to it?
You know, our assistant general manager with the Royals told us once that, you know, the big leaguers are the ones who actually believe they are big leaguers. So of course you're going to entertain those thoughts. But another analogy that was laid out to us by our pitching coach Jim Brower, a former major leaguer with the Braves, the Giants, and a few other teams, he essentially said, you know, it's fairly straightforward. Minor league baseball is a ladder, and once you get to Double A, you're pretty close to the top of the ladder, and you can just almost see over the top. However, you know, things get ugly when you start looking down or you start looking up, and really you just need to focus on that next rung. And for us, you know, we're in Midland, Texas, playing the Midland Rockhounds, the Double A affiliate of the Oakland A's. The next rung for me is getting out whoever I face tonight, and you know, that's really it. So, yeah, of course you're going to entertain those ideas, but if you get too hung up on what's, you know, a week ahead of you or even, you know, a day ahead of you, then you might get into a little bit of trouble.
Now, Andrew, it's not too ugly if every time you turn around you see Susan Sarandon.
No, I wouldn't complain about that.
Tell me about your season so far. How are you doing, and are you coming out of the bullpen, starting? How's it going?
I'm a reliever now, so I haven't started since, I guess, May of 2012 against UCLA. That was my last start at Jackie Robinson Stadium. So I'm officially a full-time reliever. I've made one appearance. Our team itself is 2-3. We won our first series, and then we lost two heartbreakers yesterday and then the day before that. So I came out of the bullpen in our first game of the year, and we won that game, so that was exciting. And, you know, didn't give up any runs, so it wasn't the cleanest outing, but you know, we won the game, and that's what's important.
Now, let me ask you this. You played for a Mercedes-Benz college program. How does life as a USC baseball player compare to life as a single-A or double-A baseball player?
You know, I wouldn't, at least from a competition standpoint, it's obviously there are some differences, but I would say the perks, I mean, the Royals do a wonderful job of taking care of us. I think they're probably near the top of the list in terms of how they treat their minor leaguers. But you do feel, I don't want to say special, but there are definitely more perks, I guess, associated with playing at a larger college. We fly almost.
I imagine you travel better for the USC Trojans than you do for the Northwest Arkansas Naturals.
Yeah, you absolutely do. So we're on standard buses, so in about 24 hours I'll be just getting back into Fayetteville tomorrow. So, they're long bus rides every now and again, and we flew everywhere in college, so that was a major difference. But overall, I mean, baseball wasn't a huge sport at USC. Football, obviously, was the number one program. So I wouldn't say there are a ton of differences, but there definitely are a few, and travel probably being the most prominent of those.
When you think about where you are in baseball, what do you think you need to do to make that last leap up to what Kevin Costner called the show?
Well, without getting too technical into, you know, specific things I need to work on or individual players need to work on, it's really consistency. That's what you've heard from day one from, you know, coaches in A-ball or rookie ball all the way up to, you know, big league coaches. If you get some interaction with them, and it's, you know, your sophomore year of college, your best breaking ball is just as good as your big league best breaking ball. So really it's just about being able to repeat that. And that's really what the innings are for and the at-bats are for hitters, are really sort of cultivating that consistency. And those are the guys that get to the big leagues. It's not necessarily the supreme talents, the guys who always throw the hardest or the guys who hit the ball the farthest. It's the guys.
It's doing it over and over again.
Exactly. Who can be average or above average the most often.
And just in terms of the day-to-day experience, you know, I was talking with Lucas earlier about, you know, is it joyful like it was for kids playing, you know, when they're young, or is it very, very high stress kind of situation? How does it feel to you day-to-day?
Oh, this sounds kind of hokey, but honestly, every level of baseball has been more fun than the one before it. And that goes, you know, college was more fun for me than high school, and, you know, pro ball has actually been a little bit more fun than college. And I think part of that's a function of, you know, not having 23-page papers due while you're trying to get somebody out. Really, right now, this is all we do. So we've got an unbelievable group of guys, and you're really hanging out with 24 of your buddies every single day. So, yes, it can
Do you play with any guys you played college ball with?
No, I played with guys that I played against in college, and you'll run into college teammates every now and again on the road, which is exciting, but no one I played with for my college team.
And what's your plan? You know, one of the themes that Lucas explored in his book was, you know, there's some players who go into the minor leagues who got big bonuses and high draft picks, and they're sort of ticketed for the major leagues, and there are others who are trying to break through and get to that place. When you think about your baseball career, how long do you intend to stick with it? And have you set yourself an up or out kind of target?
Really, for me right now, I signed, like you said, I was neither a high draft pick nor did I get a very big bonus. So, you know, this is my second full season. So I signed after the draft in 2012. But as a 25-year-old relief pitcher in AA, you know, you are really the most expendable part of any team as a relief pitcher. So for me, it's really a year-by-year proposition. That said, I think I have a skill set that's unique enough to where I could do this for a long time. But, you know, if any point, you know, that train leaves the tracks, then I would obviously, you know, I don't want to say I would not hesitate to move on to something else, but I'm fully aware of my place in the game, but I'm also aware of, you know, what I can do. So, but at the end of the day, that's what the off season's for. The off season's for, you know, getting a job and trying to cultivate something of a skill set that's translatable beyond, you know, how to throw a sinker down in the zone or how to grip a curveball or things like that. So,
Lucas, how does Andrew's experience sound compared to the pitchers and players and Clinton you hung around with?
I mean, I think that sort of there's like a remarkable amount of maturity and clarity that Andrew seems to have that I was sort of amazed that even some of the younger players in Clinton had that sort of kind of zen-like quality that baseball emphasizes of this one pitch or this one at bat or this one game is the only thing that I can control. But also, I mean,
is that a reflection of the fact that you grow up fast in that kind of environment?
I don't know. I was just sort of consistently amazed by that. And I also, I mean, there were guys like sports psychologists that teams would bring in for certain players that would emphasize that. But also, I mean, congratulations to Andrew. I think double A is really different than single A. And I think the way he put it of being on that rung and almost being able to see where he wants to go, I think that must be a very different feeling than the guys I was around got.
Guys, I want to play one more clip from Bull Durham that touched me because it connected to a story that Lucas told in his book. In this scene, Crash Davis convinces the head coach played by Trey Wilson to scare his players into playing better. The coach has no better alternative but to heed his advice by shouting at them as they stand naked in the shower. Here's the clip.
You lollygag the ball around the infield. You lollygag your way down to first. You lollygag in and out of the dugout. And you know what that makes you, Larry?
Lollygaggers.
Lollygaggers. What's our record, Larry?
8-16.
How'd we ever win 8?
It's a miracle.
It's a miracle. This is a simple game. You throw the ball. You hit the ball. You catch the ball. You got it!
Andrew, does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I've heard a few of those in my time.
Lucas, you had a story in your book in which the manager of the Lumber Kings and Phil Plantier, a former player for the Red Sox, are in a bar, and Plantier is grousing about the players that they don't execute like they used to when he was little. They get paid big bonuses for getting one hit and showing that they're fast. They can't track these minor league fastballs. What's the relationship like between the managers, many of them who are former major league players, and their players in the minors?
Yeah, the term lollygag was definitely not used. It was a different register of language. But, you know, I think that's another interesting tension. When I was around the Lumber Kings, I think it was unique for A-ball in that the manager, the pitching coach, and the hitting coach were all older. They were all in their 50s and 60s, and I think sort of had a little more calm to them as a result and sort of a little more chance to look back on the game. But in general, right, sometimes you'll get a manager who's 30 who whose own playing aspirations only recently just ended. And I think that sports kind of cultivates that sense of these guys have it so much easier than I did. So I think always they're right. I mean, these guys know what they're talking about, but I can't imagine that if you're a manager or a coach, you're not looking at these players and in some way thinking about the way you swung or the way you pitched and if somebody would have treated you the way they treat them, what might have happened.
I want to go to one of our callers. We've got Bob on the line from Belmont, Massachusetts. Bob, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Oh, hi, John. Well, just a couple of thoughts. We were just down at Fort Myer for spring training, saw four Red Sox games, and at one of the games, we got to the JetBlue Park, or Fenway South, as they call it. We got there early and watched the players take batting practice and fielding practice, and most of the players we saw were these minor leaguers, and they were good players, but you just kind of wondered philosophically how many of them were actually going to be brought up at some point in their careers. Aspiring major league players, there was dozens of them.
Bob, thanks so much for your call. Now, Andrew, how about you? Did you and some of your teammates go to those major league camps and train with the major leaguers and get a glimpse of it there?
Yeah, we did. They're actually, it was divided up, major league camp and minor league camp, but a lot of times, just depending on work schedules and who had thrown innings where and which position players needed days off, a lot of time older minor leaguers would go over and play in the big league game. So that was something I did. My group of five other pitchers, I would go over and back up in the big league bullpen. So I actually got into one of the major league spring training games. But
nice.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience, really getting to see it up close and seeing their routines of the big league bullpen guys. And really the best part is you see they're really not that different from you. It just goes back to the consistency thing I spoke of earlier.
Well, I was going to ask you, and I'm going to let you go in a minute, but when you see up close their game and your game, do you think of the line between the quality of play where you're playing and the majors as being extremely thin and not that much difference, or do you think of it as a large gap?
Depending on the night, it can be an extremely thin or non-existent gap. Other nights, it can be pretty. It's a big chasm. Like last night, if you saw our game, you would have said this is a low A team, because it was just sloppy on both sides. There were 50 people there. It was just bad. But, it really just depends. And like I said, not to, beat a dead horse, but it is a consistency thing. So, you might catch us tonight and it'll be, two big league teams going at it. But
I was at Fenway last night and watching the Red Sox reliever, Koji Uehara, a great reliever. He's throwing an 88-mile-an-hour fastball. I think your fastball is faster than that.
His pitch is the split. So I mean he's nasty and he commands his fastball well. So it's like I said, it's not necessarily the supreme talent. I heard somewhere that the average low A fastball is higher than the average big league fastball, and that's a function of consistency and throwing your pitches for strikes where you want to and in the right count. So it's interesting. That's why it's a skill sport. That's why the minor league exists. If it was just about talent, then you wouldn't need five levels of minor league baseball.
Andrew Triggs, good luck tonight against the Midland Rockhounds. We're discussing the minor league field of dreams. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about the minor leagues. In the studio with me today is Lucas Mann. He's the author of Class A, Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere. And joining us now from Pensacola, Florida, Tommy Thrall, radio announcer for the Pensacola Blue Wahoos, the AA affiliate of the Cincinnati Reds. He also announced in the St. Louis Cardinals organization with their single-A affiliate, the Quad Cities River Bandits. Tommy Thrall, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me on. Appreciate it, John.
Tommy, I have to say first off that I think even Vin Scully would envy the name Tommy Thrall. That's pretty great for a radio announcer. Is that a stage name or is that your real name?
No, it's my given name, Thomas. Thomas is of course my full name, but yeah, it's funny that you bring that up because I've been quoted in articles before, and I've been involved in some promotions for some teams that were somewhat criticized, and my name was actually being made fun of a little bit because people thought I was working for a team called the T-Bones at the time, and people thought there was no way it was a real name. They said, Tommy Troll with the T-Bones, no way that's real, but it really is.
Now, Tommy, are you like the players on the teams that you're announcing? Are you also seeing yourself as somebody climbing that ladder and hoping to announce at the major league level?
Absolutely, 100%. I think most of us in the same position are. You know, that's the ultimate goal. That's where the lifestyle gets. It's safe to say it gets easier. It's certainly a little better. You live more comfortably, and the travel's a heck of a lot easier, and you don't have as many job responsibilities. So,
pretty interesting identification that you have with the players.
Yeah, it is, and you know we're all in the same boat. They the ones that make it up there usually make it a little quicker than the broadcasters, just because you know the guys that get to the big league level in this field, they don't typically leave. So there's fewer openings every year, and
yeah, there's 25 roster slots on a baseball team, and there's one play-by-play announcer.
and broadcasters don't typically get called up for a cup of coffee like they do.
Tommy, let me ask you to set the scene. Tell me about your team. Is it a good team? Do you have any surefire major leaguers on it? Tell me what the capacity is of the stadium you announce in, and what does it cost to buy a ticket there?
Tickets range anywhere from $6 up to about $15. So tickets are very affordable, which is pretty consistent around minor league baseball. That's the one goal, is to have affordable family fun, and we certainly have that. It's a small ballpark. It's intimate. Pensacola isn't a huge market for a double-A team, so we have a smaller ballpark that seats just over 5,000 people. But one of the things that does is it creates an exciting environment for games that night in and night out. Last year we sold out better than 30 games. So
That's impressive.
It is. Yeah, it is. It's and that's something that we're very proud of, because we keep the demand up for tickets, and having a smaller ballpark does that, which also a smaller ballpark keeps the enthusiasm in the crowd up. You go to some of these ballparks that see 10,000 people and maybe only 4,000 show up, well, it feels empty. You have a 5,000-seat stadium and 4,000 show up, it feels packed. So, and that's all part of creating the game day experience, and that's what we have. We have great fans here in Pensacola that show up, support the team, and show up night in and night out. We had four sellouts on this homestand, and three of those nights were really, really rainy. So, in fact, we didn't think we were going to get the game in. We were still selling tickets as people were walking up to the gates in the pouring rain, which was just remarkable. But people really like this team here. It's still relatively new. We're just in our third season, and I think the fans will finally have a team to root for that will actually win some ball games this year. We've struggled a bit in the first 2 years, but our pitching staff looks excellent this year.
Do you have any blue-chip future major leaguers on that team?
Yeah, we do. I think pretty much all five guys in our starting rotation have a good shot to make the big leagues, including we have the Reds' number one overall prospect in Robert Stevenson. He struck out 11 guys the other night, so he is he's off to a good start. And it's funny because I talked to a bunch of the scouts after the game, and the one thing that was consistent, even our manager, Delino DeShield, said it, he had big league stuff. He looked like a big leaguer out on the mound. His fastball hit as high as 90 miles an hour. His curveball and his off-speed stuff was excellent as well. So, yeah, I think he's as sure of a bat as you can get in minor league baseball. Of course, we say that about guys, and then something or other that can derail them. It's such a fine line between getting there and not getting there. It's always hard to say, but I think he's about as close as we have to being ready to get up there.
Tommy, I want to give our listeners a chance to hear not just your public radio voice, but your actual game voice. We've got a clip from a game last year, I believe. Here's Tommy Thrall in action.
Here's the pitch. And this one is well hit to left. Canna going back. That's over his head and off the wall. Lutz will score. Mateer's into second base with a go-ahead double.
Before I get to my next question, Tommy, do you have a signature home run call?
I really don't. I get asked that all the time, and some people tell me that's a good thing. Other people like to tell me, "Oh, come on, you have to have a signature." But I really don't. I don't know. I've never really come up with one, and I always think that the good ones that people have are somewhat natural, and they don't just come up with it to have it. And
so you're waiting for it to spring out naturally.
Exactly. Yeah. If there's something that comes up naturally, then good for that. But otherwise, no. I just don't. I think a lot of them sometimes sound forced. So, and that's not really my style.
Tommy, Lucas had a passage in his book where he's referring to the announcer for the Clinton Lumber Kings, and the announcer was getting a question: how many people are listening to you when you're broadcasting? And the announcer indicated that I think he was sort of mixed in whether very few, or then he sort of stopped himself and wanted to believe a lot more people are listening. Do you know how many are listening, and are you talking out to a void, or are you talking to a big crowd out there?
I think in Pensacola we have decent listenership. It's really hard to tell. I have no idea, to be quite honest. I will say I was in a conversation much like this at the airport a few months back, and once I hung up the phone, a guy asked me, "So are you ready for baseball season to start?" I had no idea who this guy was. He was working the counter at one of the gates of the airport, and he said, "Oh, by the way, I listen to all the games and recognize your voice while you're on the phone." So apparently people are listening, and that was kind of neat. I'm not really used to that in other markets I've worked in, but I get recognized from time to time from people around town, which is just kind of fun, I'll be honest. And but that tells me that, yeah, people are listening. So that's basically all I have to base it on is that stuff.
Tommy, I want to go to one of our callers. We've got Tim from Menominee, Wisconsin. Tim, I'm sure I mangled that name, but you're on the air. What's your question?
Hello, John. I am wondering, I've heard that coaches in the minor leagues have the toughest job because they're coaching a team of players that don't really want to be there. I'm wondering if there's any truth to that.
Lucas?
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, in some sense, right, that has to be true, right? I mean, why would you want to be a single-A baseball player when you want to be a major leaguer? On the other hand, you're getting really young guys who I think really good managers, like I saw, you know, get the players to believe that this is the guy who will make me not be here. But it is weird because nobody, your full goal can't be to win a single-A championship, right? That sense of, like, we did it, team. You'd probably rather not be there at the end of the season. So, I think it's a really tough line for them to balance.
All right, we've got Ken on the line from Highlands, North Carolina. Ken, welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Hello, John. Fine, thank you. I just wanted to say, first of all, how much I enjoy your political journalism as well. And then I had a question for Mr. Mann. If in his research, was he ever able to put his hands around sort of the resource and economics of professional baseball, meaning if he had to divvy up what percentage of their resources went to the pros versus the double A versus the single A, because I know they have various levels, and it just somewhat interests me.
Ken, thanks for the call. Lucas?
Yeah, thanks, Ken. I don't know exactly. It's when you're around it, it seems pretty top heavy. If you have a team of guys in single A that are making, probably nobody's really making more than $1,500 a month. And then you have a major league team where everybody who's on that 40-man roster is guaranteed at least $400,000 a year. And some are multi-millionaires. It shrinks fast. And also, I think that's reflected that the major leaguers have a players union, and so they have representation in this process. Minor leaguers are not part of the MLB Players Association, and I think that is very much reflected in the way that pay drops.
Tommy, I want to ask you a question about the difference between single A and double A, and I'm not talking about quality of play. I'm talking about the prospects of the players who are playing on one versus the other. Is it a wholly different thing because once you've climbed up to double A, you're in a different class than single A Is that palpable to you as an announcer?
Yeah, no, it is. You definitely notice the difference. The play gets better the higher up you go. Double A is one of my favorite levels of baseball, I would say, outside of the big leagues. I've watched a few Triple A games. I obviously haven't seen as much of it as I have Single A and Double A, but there's a noticeable difference. If you spend a lot of time watching Single A baseball and then you go up and start watching Double A baseball, the errors are less, the pitchers throw a little firmer, their breaking stuff's a little better. They don't have as much control as they do a lot of times the next level. But you think about it, it's the best players from Single A that are now at Double A. And you can always, I think it's a little easier to determine the real prospects when you're looking at Single A teams. Sometimes at Double A, it's a little harder to identify those guys. But yeah, there's definitely a noticeable difference. The game's just a little more crisp. It's a little cleaner, and it's certainly faster paced.
Lucas, is there a class system in minor league baseball so that the Nick Franklins of the team, who've gotten big money already and know that they're ticketed to go up, are their relationships difficult with the players who are just scraping because everybody knows the difference?
I think I was sort of amazed at the general grace with which the players handled that, because everybody knows everybody else's money. And so you're in a locker room where, A, you're all in competition with each other. B, you're coming from wildly different places and cultures. And then C, you sort of know if somebody is a millionaire and you're very much not. So I think that tension was there. But at the same time, you know, I think there is still sort of a belief in this being a team. And Nick Franklin, as an example, lived in a bunch of not nice apartments with three other guys, and you know, I think maybe had the biggest room in one of them. But in general, they are a part of that group of people. And in a lot of ways, I think older players who have less invested in them are sort of charged to kind of look out for the Nick Franklins of the team, which must be an incredibly hard weight to bear for a guy who's also trying to make it himself. But it's tense, but everybody handles it really well.
Tommy, are there big regional differences in baseball? You've broadcast in Pensacola and also in the Midwest. Same culture or different?
No, I think every city is a little bit different. In the end, it's still baseball, but from the clubhouse perspective, it's pretty much the same. If you're talking about the atmosphere and the environment surrounding the teams, yeah, it's very much different, and that's city to city, because you know, we have another team that's right up the road in Mobile, which is about 45 minutes to an hour away. And if you go to a game there, it's nothing like going to a game in Pensacola. There's a team in Huntsville, Alabama, but you can go to a game in Birmingham, and the two are going to be completely different. I even think going to a game in the Quad Cities and going to a game in Clinton is much different.
And those
two teams are about 45 minutes away. So, yeah, I don't know that it's certainly – I don't know that it's as much regional as much as it is just individual city to city.
And if I could – sorry, could I jump? If I could add, too, the Quad Cities Clinton example is a great one, because, you know, a lot of people wouldn't have heard of either of those places outside of Iowa, but Clinton is sort of the little brother to the Quad Cities. And in that 45-mile strip of highway, there is a huge amount of people feeling cultural differences between those places. And if you're in Clinton, the narrative when Quad Cities comes to play is like the obnoxious big city folk are in town.
I want to go to one more caller. We've got Mary on the line from Evansville, Indiana. Mary, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, John, and thank you for taking my call. In Evansville, we have enjoyed phenomenal AAA. We, in the 70s and 80s, hosted the Detroit Tigers Farm Club, the Evansville Triplets, and saw the likes of Mark the Bird Sitterich and Lance Parrish, among others. Jim Leyland was the manager. And unfortunately, we lost AAA, but now have AA. So, huge fan base in this community for minor league baseball. And I love hearing your guests speak with such passion. The fans are out there.
Mary, thanks so much for your call. And Lucas, Mary sounds like one of the members of the family of the Clinton team that you wrote about.
Yeah, I was. That was one of the things that was sort of unexpected for me in taking on the project. I just sort of assumed that I would be writing about baseball and the players, but writing about the minors, and you know, I think Mary is proving this. You can't write about it without really talking about the fans, and they are so integral to that experience, and they're the ones who are there. I mean, the players constantly shift, the managers constantly shift, the major league team affiliations constantly shift.
You had one woman there who brought Jolly Ranchers to these young kids who seemed to appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, her name is Betty, and some of the players called her Grandma Betty, and she was a wonderful person who, I think she's slowing down on that from the last time I talked to her. But yeah, her role in that world was through generations of players sitting in her same seat, putting candy out by the dugout and sort of greeting them and saying, you look like you might want some candy.
Even Betty loses a couple of miles an hour on her fastball as she gets older. I want to thank my guests for joining us today. Tommy Thrall, radio announcer for the Pensacola Blue Wahoos, the AA affiliate of the Cincinnati Reds. Thanks so much, Tommy, and go Wahoos.
All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. It was fun.
And Lucas Mann, author of Class A, Baseball in the Middle of Everywhere. Lucas, thanks to you too.
Thanks so much. I had a blast.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, cats and dogs as family members, pet parenthood. Our relationship with our pets is changing, and we'll take a look. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thank you.